Mr. Sponge's Sporting Tour by R.S. Surtees. Chapter 15. The Jollyford Establishment. The loud peal of the Jollyford Court doorbell, announcing Mr. Sponge's arrival, with which we closed the last chapter, found the inhabitants variously engaged preparing for his reception. Mrs. Jollyford, with the aid of a very indifferent cook, was endeavoring to arrange a becoming dinner. The young ladies, with the aid of a somewhat better sort of maid, were attractifying themselves, each looking with considerable jealousy on the efforts of the other. And Mr. Jollyford was trotting from room to room, eyeing the various pictures of himself, wondering which was now the most like, and watching the emergence of curtains, carpets, and sofas from their brown holland covers. A gleam of sunshine seemed to reign throughout the mansion, the long-covered furniture appearing to have gained freshness by its retirement, just as a newly done-up hat surprises the wearer by its goodness. A few days, however, soon restores the defects of either. All these arrangements were suddenly brought to a close by the peal of the doorbell, just as the little stage tinkle of a theatre stops preparation and compels the actors to stand forward as they are. Mrs. Jollyford threw aside her silk apron and took a hasty glance of her face in the old eagle-topped mirror in the still-room. The young ladies discarded their coarse, dirty pocket handkerchiefs and gently drew elaborate fringed ones through their taper fingers to give them an air of use, as they took a hasty review of themselves in the swing mirrors. The housemaid hurried off with a whole armful of brown holland, and Jollyford threw himself into attitude in an elaborately carved, richly cushioned easy-chair, with a Disraeli's Life of Lord George Bentinck in his hand. But Jollyford's thoughts were far from his book. He was sitting on thorns, lest there might not be a proper guard of honour to receive Mr. Sponge at the entrance. Jollyford, as we said before, was not the man to entertain unless he could do it properly. And as we all have our pitch notes of propriety up to which we play, we may state that Jollyford's note was a butler and two footmen. A butler and two footmen he looked upon as perfectly indispensable to receiving company. He chose to have two footmen to follow the butler, who followed the gentleman to the spacious flight of steps leading from the great hall to the portico as he mounted his horse. The world is governed a good deal by appearances. Mr. Jollyford started life with two most unimpeachable Johns. They were nearly 6 feet high, heads well up, and legs that might have done for models for a sculptor. They powdered with the greatest propriety, and by 2 o'clock each day were silk-stockinged and pumped in full-dress Jollyford livery, sky-blue coats with massive silver aiguillettes, and broad silver seams down the front and round their waistcoat pocket flaps, silver garters at their crimson plush breeches knees, and thus attired they were ready to turn out with the butler to receive visitors and conduct them back to their carriages. Gradually they came down in style, but not in number, and when Mr. Sponge visited Mr. Jollyford, he had a sort of out-of-door man-of-all-work who metamorphosed himself into a second footman at short notice.
"My dear Mr. Sponge, I am delighted to see you," exclaimed Mr. Jollyford, rising from his easy-chair and throwing his Disraeli's Bentinck aside, as Mr. Spigot, the butler, in a deep, sonorous voice, announced our worthy friend.
"This is indeed most truly kind of you," continued Jollyford, advancing to meet him, and getting our friend by both hands, he began working his arms up and down like the underman in a saw-pit. "This is truly most kind," he repeated. "I assure you I shall never forget it. It's just what I like. It's just what Mrs. Jollyford likes. It's just what we all like, coming without fuss or ceremony. Spigot," he added, hailing old Pomposo as the latter was slowly withdrawing, thinking what a humbug his master was. "Spigot," he repeated in a louder voice, "let the ladies know Mr. Sponge is here. Come to the fire, my dear fellow," continued Jollyford, clutching his guest by the arm and drawing him towards where an ample grate of indifferent coals was crackling and spluttering beneath a magnificent old oak mantelpiece of the richest and costliest carved work.
"Come to the fire, my dear fellow," he repeated, "for you feel cold, and I don't wonder at it, for the day is cheerless and uncomfortable, and you've had a long ride. Will you take anything before dinner?"
"What time do you dine?" asked Mr. Sponge, rubbing his hands as he spoke.
6 o'clock, replied Mr. Jollyford. 6 o'clock, say 6 o'clock. Not particular to a moment. Days are short, you see. Days are short.
I think I should like a glass of sherry and a biscuit, then, observed Mr. Sponge. And forthwith the bell was rung, and in due course of time Mr. Spigot arrived with a tray, followed by the Miss Jollyfords, who had rather expected Mr. Sponge to be shown into the drawing-room to them, where they had composed themselves very prettily, one working a parrot in chenille, the other with a lapful of crochet. The Miss Jollyfords, Amelia and Emily, were lively girls, hardly beauties, at least not sufficiently so to attract attention in a crowd, but still girls well calculated to bring a man to book in the country. Mr. Thackeray, who bound up all the home truths in circulation, and many that exist only in the inner chambers of the heart, calling the whole Vanity Fair, says, we think, though we don't exactly know where to lay hand on the passage, that it is not your real striking beauties who are the most dangerous, at all events, that do the most execution, but sly, quiet sort of girls, who do not strike the beholder at first sight, but steal insensibly upon him as he gets acquainted. The Miss Jollyfords were of this order. Seen in plain morning gowns, a man would meet them in the street without either turning round or making an observation, good, bad, or indifferent. But in the close quarters of a country house, with all the able assistance of first-rate London dresses, well flounced and set out, each bent on doing the agreeable, they became dangerous. The Miss Jollyfords were uncommonly well got up, and Juliana, their mutual maid, deserved great credit for the impartiality she displayed in arraying them. There wasn't a halfpenny's worth of choice as to which was the best. This was the more creditable to the maid, inasmuch as the dresses, sea-green glacés, were rather dashed, and the worse they looked, the likelier they would be to become her property. Half-dashed dresses, however, that would look rather seedy by contrast, come out very fresh in the country, especially in winter, when day begins to close in at 4. And here we may observe, what a dreary time is that which intervenes between the arrival of a guest and the dinner hour in the dead winter in the country. The English are a desperate people for overweighting their conversational powers. They have no idea of penning up their small talk and bringing it to bear in generous flow upon one particular hour, but they keep dribbling it out throughout the livelong day, wearying their listeners without benefiting themselves, just as a careless wagoner scatters his load on the road. Few people are insensible to the advantage of having their champagne brisk, which can only be done by keeping the cork in, but few ever think of keeping the cork of their own conversation in. See a Frenchman! How light and buoyant he trips into the drawing-room, fresh from the satisfactory scrutiny of the looking-glass, with all the news and jokes and tittle-tattle of the day in full bloom! How sparkling and radiant he is, with something smart and pleasant to say to everyone! How thoroughly happy and easy he is! And what a contrast to phlegmatic John Bull, who stands with his great red fists doubled, looking as if he thought whoever spoke to him would be wanting him to endorse a bill of exchange. But, as we said before, the dread hour before dinner is an awful time in the country. Frightful when there are 2 hours, and never a subject in common for the company to work upon. Laverick Wells and their mutual acquaintance was all Sponge and Jollyford stock in trade, and that was a very small capital to begin upon, for they had been there together too short a time to make much of a purse of conversation. Even the young ladies, with their inquiries after the respective flirtations, how Miss Sawney and Captain Snubnose were getting on, and whether the rich Widow Spankley was likely to bring Sir Thomas Greedy to book, failed to make up a conversation, for Sponge knew little of the ins and outs of these matters, his attention having been more directed to Mr. Waffles than anyone else. Still, the mere questions, put in a playful, womanly way, helped the time on, and prevented things coming to that frightful deadlock of silence that causes an involuntary inward exclamation of, "How am I to get through the time with this man?" There are people who seem to think that sitting and looking at each other constitutes society. Women have a great advantage over men in the talking way. They always have something to say. Let a lot of women be huddled together throughout the whole of a livelong day, and they will yet have such a balance of conversation at night as to render it necessary to convert a bedroom into a clearing-house to get rid of it. Men, however, soon get high and dry, especially before dinner, and a host ought to be at liberty to read the Riot Act and disperse them to their bedrooms till such times as they wanted to eat and drink. A most scientifically sounded gong, beginning low, like distant thunder, and gradually increasing its murmur till it filled the whole mansion with its roar, at length relieved all parties from the labor of further efforts. And, looking at his watch, Jollyford asked Mrs. Jollyford, in an innocent, indifferent sort of way, which was Mr. Sponge's room, though he had been fussing about it not long before, and dusting the portrait of himself in his green and gold yeomanry uniform with an old hot-pocket handkerchief. "The crimson room, my dear," replied the well-drilled Mrs. Jollyford, and Spigot coming with candles, Jollyford preceded Mr. Sponge up a splendid, richly carved oak staircase, of such gradual and easy rise that an invalid might almost have been drawn up it in a garden chair. Passing a short distance along a spacious corridor, Mr. Jollyford presently opened a door to the right and led the way into a large, gloomy room, with a little newly lighted wood fire crackling in an enormous grate, making darkness visible and drawing the cold out of the walls. We need scarcely say it was that terrible room, the best, with three creaking, ill-fitting windows and heavy crimson satin damask furniture so old as scarcely to be able to sustain its own weight.
"Ah, here you are," observed Mr. Jollyford as he nearly tripped over Sponge's luggage as it stood by the fire. "Here you are," repeated he, giving the candle a flourish to show the size of the room, and draw it back on the portrait of himself above the mantelpiece.
"Ah, I declare, here's an old picture of myself," said he, holding the candle up to the face as if he hadn't seen it for some time. "A picture that was done when I was in the Bumperkin Yeomanry," continued he, passing the light before the facings. "That was considered a good likeness at the time," said he, looking affectionately at it and feeling his nose to see if it was still the same size. "Ours was a capital corps, one of the best, if not the very best, in the service. The inspecting officer always spoke of it in the highest possible terms, especially of my company, which really was just as perfect as anything my Lord Cardigan or any of your crack disciplinarians can produce. However, never mind," continued he, lowering the candle, seeing Mr. Sponge didn't enter into the spirit of the thing. "You'll be wanting to dress. You'll want to find hot water on the table yonder," pointing to the far corner of the room, where the outline of a jug might just be descried. "There's a bell in the bed if you want anything, and dinner will be ready as soon as you are dressed. You needn't make yourself very fine," added he as he retired, "for we are only ourselves. Hope we shall have some of our neighbors tomorrow or next day, but we are rather badly off for neighbors just here, at least for short-notice neighbors." So saying, he disappeared through the dark doorway. The latter statement was true enough, for Jollyford, though apparently such a fine, open-hearted, sociable sort of man,
was in reality a very quarrelsome, troublesome fellow. He quarreled with all his neighbors in succession, generally getting through them every 2 or 3 years, and his acquaintance was divided into 2 classes, the best and the worst fellows under the sun. A stranger revising Jollyford after an absence of 1 or 2 would very likely find the best fellows of former days transformed into the worst ones of that. Thus, Parson Hobbinob, that pet victim of country caprice, would go in and go out of season like lamb or asparagus. Major Mustache and Jollyford would be as thick as thieves one day and daggers drawn the next. Squire Squaretoes of Squaretoes House and he were continually kissing or cutting, and even distance, 9 miles of bad road and, of course, heavy tolls, could not keep the peace between lawyer Seedywig and him. What between rows and reconciliations, Jollyford was always at work. End of chapter 15.